You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
We acknowledge that we meet on Kaurna land and we honour the ongoing connection of the Kaurna people with their land. Today's service is on the subject of love. The greatest happiness in life is the conviction that we are loved, loved for ourselves, or rather, loved in spite of ourselves. That was from Victor Hugo. I'm going to ask Grant to light the chalice this morning. This might be the end of Hugh's candle. This was the last one that he made. Let this flame remind us to be kind, to be helpful, and to be loving. Good morning and welcome to our service of worship. It's lovely to see so many faces that we haven't seen for a while. This is worship, a worship service, because it means to serve you by raising to worth things that matter. My name's Jenny Dyster, I'm the lay leader of the congregation, and I welcome you here on behalf of the generations of Unitarians who've worshipped in similar gatherings since 1854. We're a spiritual community that encourages and supports all who come to find, fashion, and follow their own spiritual path. Any path that helps you see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world for all. You're invited to join us after the service for coffee, tea, and conversations. Before we do candles of concern, I thought I didn't have a children's story today, but Brendan turned up with "I love you, stinky face." And I read it through, it was horrible. Actually, it was tangled up in some music. I think it was left here by Tiny Tempos. But then I thought to myself, what about Beauty and the Beast? I remember Beauty and the Beast. There was a picture of the man with a lion's head, and that was supposed to be the beast, and I thought he looked rather good myself, but there you go. So I went and looked for it, and I came up with the original translated into English. It was 18 pages long, and I thought, it's possibly a bit long, a story for all ages. But I read the whole thing through, and it's really interesting. It's much more complicated than the little kiddie version that I read as a child, and it seems to contain the germ of an awful lot of stories. So I thought, well, why not do from memory? You know I'm not going to remember 18 pages, don't you? It's 16 if you shrink the margins. Anyway, you've got a merchant, rich as they usually are, with six kids. Three boys, three girls. And the girls are of a pattern you may recognise before. The oldest two are only mixing with people of quality, and they're into balls and parties and all that sort of stuff. And the youngest, guess what? She spends her time reading good books. Well, that's a virtue signal, isn't it, right from the start? Well, it just so happens that there's a marine disaster and the merchant loses his money, all except for a country house, which is quite a long way from the city where they live. So they have to decamp into the country and basically keep a farm going. Now, as you might imagine, the two older girls refused to go. They thought their suitors would just rescue them, marry them. But of course the suitors, since they'd been stripped of cash, were no longer interested. So they had to join Dad and the little girl, who was, by the way, called Beauty, because she was even better looking than the older two. So you don't have three ugly sisters, you have three pretty sisters, but two pretty sisters and one beautiful sister, and the beautiful one's called Beauty, much to the chagrin of her older two. Well, as you might imagine, they fret, grumble, and groan a lot about living on the farm, whereas Beauty throws herself into milking cows and digging in the garden and cleaning and washing and all that sort of stuff, and they really despise her for taking pleasure in such menial tasks. Meanwhile, the father gets a letter to say that some of the sunken ship's stuff has been recovered and he can go and claim it. So he travels quite a long distance and finds that indeed that there is a box of gold that was reclaimable, so he loads it up. And he's on his way back, loses his way in the forest, takes a wrong turn, and a storm starts. Just dreadful, blowing, windy, sleet, then blizzard sort of conditions. And he miraculously sees a castle. There's no one there. He goes in, and it's as if it's all been planned. There's a real magic feel to this, because he goes in and there's a suit of clothes laid out, a steaming cup of hot chocolate, a magnificent feast. And then when he goes to bed, beautiful four-poster bed, it's warm. Somebody's warmed it. And in the morning, he decides it's time to go home. And he remembers that the older daughters had asked for gifts, which he'd completely forgotten. Anyway, he hadn't had time to spend anything, so they weren't going to miss out. But he spotted a rose, and of course the younger one had only asked for a rose, and he plucked it. And the minute he plucked it, a beast appeared. And the beast was furious. I've given you hot chocolate, I've given you a suit of clothes, I've given you everything, and then you steal one of my roses. Classic catch. And so in order to save his life, penalties for theft being rather more dreadful than they are now, he had to promise the most valuable, beautiful thing that he had at home. Well, that's obvious, isn't it? It's Beauty. So he goes home, and she actually consents to going to the castle of the beast to save her father from death. And when she goes, she's quite well treated, and she's not too sure what's going on, but after about a week of nice treatment, he asks her to marry him. And with great fear and trepidation, she answers, no. And do you find me ugly? And with great fear and trepidation, she replied, yes. But she said, I have agreed to stay here with you. And so she does. And after a year, he rewards her with a 3-month visit home. Now, meanwhile, at home, with a little bit of money and so on, the girls have married off, and they're rather delighted, quite pleased with themselves, because things have come quite good, until they see what Beauty comes home with, and it's trunks overflowing with silk gowns and jewellery, much better than anything that they've ever had, and they are, of course, overcome with jealousy. So at the end of the 3 months, they decide what they've got to do is to stuff things up for her. So they persuade her to stay another week so that she's broken the contract of the 3 months. And Beauty does, and she's a bit worried about it. But this is the first time in her life she's ever been treated nicely by her sisters. So this is irresistible. Anyway, when she goes home to the castle of the beast, she can't find him. Can't find him anywhere. In the end, she goes down to the river, and there he is, lying in the mud by the side of the river, prostrate with grief. He was quite sure that he'd lost her. He didn't seem to be breathing. And she was so heartbroken, she sobbed and had to go at resuscitating him, so she thought. And suddenly, What happened was he was transformed into a handsome prince, which is what happens. This is how virtue is rewarded in the end every time, isn't it? And it's because of the purity of her heart and the fact that she really did love him. Of course, then they get married and it's all happily ever after, etc. Except for one thing. The other daughters, those two, they get punished somehow. But I can't remember, so you'll have to look it up yourself. It's only 18 pages long. It's now come to that time in the service when we have candles of joy, concern, and insight. We've come to that time of quiet contemplation in the service, and the meditation today is from John Donohue. Love is the nature of the soul. You may close your eyes or just cast them down. The soul needs love as urgently as the body needs air. In the warmth of love, the soul can be itself. All the possibilities of your human destiny are asleep in your soul. You are here to realize and honor these possibilities. When love comes into your life, unrecognized dimensions of your destiny awaken and blossom and grow. When we love and allow ourselves to be loved, we begin more and more to inhabit the kingdom of the eternal. Fear changes into courage. Emptiness becomes plenitude, and distance becomes intimacy. The Anamkara, its care of the soul, experience opens a friendship that is not wounded or limited by separation or distance. Such friendship can remain alive even when the friends live far away from each other, because they have broken through the barriers of persona and egoism to the soul level. The unity of their souls is not easily severed. When the soul is awakened, physical space is transfigured. Even across the distance, two friends can stay attuned to each other and continue to sense the flow of each other's lives. With your Anamkara, you awaken the eternal. In this soul space, there is no distance. Love is our deepest nature. Consciously or unconsciously, each of us searches for love. We often choose such false ways to satisfy this deep hunger. An excessive concentration on work, achievements, or spiritual quest can actually lead us away from the presence of love. In the work of our soul, our false urgency can mislead us. We do not need to go out to find love. Rather, we need to be still and let love discover us. Well, I'm going to be direct. Most of you will want to eat lunch before 2 p.m. Some of you have short attention spans and others have heard it all before. Love. I mean, you've heard pulpit meanderings on charity, eros, storge, philia, and agape. Remember agape? Con the fruiter is youngest. Tula, bula, sula, and agape. So I will stick to love in the short version. English, no Greek. Restricted meaning. Romantic subtype leading up to marriage or similar. love. It's a big enough topic, and the jazz standards will work. I wanted David to sing a month ago, but he wasn't keen on singing about a Bill of Rights. He's a lawyer, for heaven's sake. I thought he'd jump at the chance. Anyhow, no matter. First two numbers have been lovely. Love is the main theme of many songs, operas, stories, movies, plays, ballets, you name it. It's also a topic that excruciates many young viewers. Tell me when I can open my eyes, my nephew used to say when a love scene began on TV. My mum was a great Beatles fan. The appeal for her was the simple joy expressed in songs like Love, Love Me Do, I Know I Love You, and or I Want to Hold Your Hand, in contrast to the implied stalking in Return to Sender, or the one-sided nature of love in Hey Mr. Postman, even though those latter songs had catchy tunes and lively rhythms. The word love is much abused. If you really loved me, you wouldn't say that. He only pulls your hair because he likes you. Like being understood as the precursor to love, a junior version, you might say. No wonder kids are sus about love. In the Bible, in the Old Testament, love is the subject of outrageous tales. I'm sure you all know the story of Samson and Delilah, but maybe not the one about Sisera and jail. I came across it because of one of Christine Mason's little jokes. She passed me some butter and said, "Excuse the lordly dish." I sensed a story, so I asked, and it turned out it were cream, not butter. He asked for water. She gave him milk. She brought him cream in a lordly dish. She stretched forth her hand to the nail, her right hand to the workman's hammer, and she smote Sisera. She crushed his head. She crashed through and transfixed his temples. That's from the Song of Deborah in the Book of Judges. And while he was dying, Sisera said to Jael, "Behold, pain has taken hold of me, Jael, and I die like a woman." And Jael said to him, "Go boast before your father in hell and tell him you have fallen into the hands of a woman." Prior to this, according to the Talmud, Jael engaged in sexual intercourse with Sisera 7 times, but because she was attempting to exhaust him in order to kill him, her sin was for heaven's sake, and therefore praiseworthy. Also, according to the Midrash, Sisera had previously conquered every country against which he'd fought. It ain't romance, is it? Nor is the story of David and Bathsheba. And there is no romance in the New Testament either. But there is love. I might save that to finish on, as it's a beautiful passage that leaves romance dead in its tracks. Meanwhile, and for the time being, I will stick to my topic, romantic love leading to the wedding and happily ever after. For most of recorded history, people married for logical sort of reasons, because this parcel of land adjoined yours, his family had a flourishing business, her father was the magistrate in town or your boss, there was a castle to keep up, or both sets of parents subscribe to the same interpretation of a religious text. And from such reasonable marriages there flowed loneliness, infidelity, abuse, and hardness of heart. The marriage of reason was not in hindsight reasonable at all. It was often expedient, narrow-minded, snobbish, and exploitative. And many playwrights, novelists, and composers of operas choose this theme and show you the consequences. That is why what has replaced it, the marriage of feeling, has been largely spared the need to account for itself, to justify itself. What matters in the marriage of feeling is that two people are drawn to each other by an overwhelming instinct, and they know in their hearts that it's right. Indeed, the more imprudent a marriage is, the safer it can feel. The prestige of instinct is the traumatized reaction against too many centuries of unreasonable reason. Is it any wonder then that so many marry the wrong person? With lust and intuition rather than reason or shared values and goals guiding our choice. At this point, it might be timely to mention that arranged marriages today are not necessarily toxic, and this is because compatibility is factored in. Income, social class, and connections are thrown into the mix as well. My friend Gunhild was brought up in India and spent her working life in IT. She's kept up with old classmates and work colleagues of Indian background working in the West. And some of these young men cannot hack the Western dating scene. So they write home when they want to marry, and the family sorts out a short list of marriage candidates. Courting proceeds by mail, phone, email, and then a face-to-face meeting. Either party could say no at any time. Gun attended one of these weddings in Delhi. Everybody in the workplace was invited from Melbourne. There was a massive 3-day celebration, and the couple were still married, and this is decades later. Now, Westerners delay marriage not so much because the dating scene is so great, but because they're so afraid of being stuck with the wrong person. They go to great lengths to avoid it, but in the end they do it anyway. Marry the wrong person. Partly it's because we have a bewildering array of problems that emerge only when we try to get close to others. We seem normal only to those who don't know us very well. I live on my own. One of the privileges of being single is the sincere impression that I am really quite easy to live with. Although most people believe themselves to be seeking happiness in marriage, it isn't that simple, because what is often sought is familiarity, which may well complicate any plans for happiness. If you're looking to recreate within an adult relationship the feelings you know so well in childhood, it's complex. In families, love's not just love necessarily. It might be confused with other more destructive dynamics, feelings of wanting to help an adult who's out of control, of being deprived of a parent's warmth or scared of his anger, or not feeling secure enough to communicate our wishes. How logical then that we should, as grown-ups, find ourselves rejecting certain candidates for marriage not because they're wrong, but because they're too right. They're too balanced, too mature, too understanding and reliable. Because in our hearts, such rightness can feel foreign. We can marry the wrong people because we don't associate being loved with feeling happy. Others make mistakes because they're so lonely. No one can be in an optimal frame of mind to choose a partner when remaining single feels unbearable. We have to be wholly at peace with the prospect of many years of solitude in order to be appropriately picky. Otherwise, we risk loving no longer being single rather more than we love the partner who spared us that fate. Finally, we marry to make a nice feeling permanent. We imagine that marriage will help us bottle the joy we felt when the thought of proposing first came. Maybe we're in Venice on the lagoon or on a beach with the evening sunset reflected in the waters, chatting about aspects of our souls no one ever seemed to have grasped before, with the prospect of dinner, Star of Greece perhaps a little later. Marrying to make such sensations permanent is doomed to failure because there is no solid connection between these feelings and the institution of marriage. Was it Mae West said? Who wants to live in an institution? Romanticism has been unhelpful to us. It is a harsh philosophy. It's made a lot of what people go through in marriage seem exceptional and appalling. They end up lonely and convinced that their union with its imperfection is not normal. British philosopher Alain de Botton teaches us in his book, The School of Life, An Emotional Education, that we should learn to accommodate ourselves to wrongness, striving always to adopt a more forgiving, humorous and kindly perspective on its multiple examples in ourselves and in our partners. And I'm now going to ask John Hall to read a little more of Alain de Botton.
The School of Life, An Emotional Education. The person who is best suited to us is not the person who shares our every taste. He or she doesn't exist, but the person who can negotiate differences in taste intelligently. The person who is good at disagreement, rather than some notional idea of perfect complementarity, it is the capacity to tolerate differences with generosity that is the true marker of not overly wrong person. Compatibility is an achievement of love. It must not be its precondition. Perhaps we have a latent tendency to get furious when someone disagrees with us, or can relax only when we are working. Perhaps we're tricky about intimacy after sex, or clam up in response to humiliation. Nobody's perfect. The problem is that before marriage, we rarely delve into our complexities. Whenever casual relationships threaten to reveal our flaws, we can blame our partners and call it a day. As for our friends, they don't care enough to do the hard work of enlightening us. Our partners are no more self-aware. Naturally, we make a stab at trying to understand them. We visit their families, we look at their photos, we meet their school or college friends. All this contributes to a sense that we've done our homework. We haven't. Marriage ends up as a hopeful, generous, infinitely kind gamble taken by two people who don't know yet who they are or who the other might be, binding themselves to a future they cannot conceive of and have carefully avoided investigating.
Thanks, John. Botton goes on to say the good news is it doesn't matter if you married the wrong person. Don't abandon him or her. Instead, abandon the founding romantic idea upon which the Western understanding of marriage has been based for the last 250 years, that a perfect being exists who can meet all our needs and satisfy our every yearning. We need to swap the romantic view, he says, for a tragicomic awareness that every human will frustrate, anger, annoy, madden, and disappoint us. And we will, with no malice aforethought, do the same to them. There can be no end to our sense of emptiness and incompleteness, but none of this is unusual or necessarily grounds for divorce. Choosing whom to commit ourselves to is merely a case of identifying which particular variety of suffering we would most like to sacrifice ourselves for. The philosophy of pessimism offers a solution to a lot of distress and agitation around marriage. It might sound odd, but pessimism relieves the excessive imaginative pressure that our romantic culture places upon marriage. The failure of one particular partner to save us from our grief and melancholy is not an argument against that person, and no sign that a union deserves to fail or be upgraded. I repeat the words John read. It is the capacity to tolerate differences with generosity that is the true marker of the right person. Compatibility is an achievement of love, not its precondition. I would like to finish today's address with the reading from the letters to the Corinthians attributed to the Apostle Paul. Now that reading, of course, covers many meanings of love. Charity, philia, storge, agape. So I took out all those bits, and it's amazing how much is left and how much does relate to loving relationships, including marriage. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered, and it keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put the ways of childhood behind me. For now we see only a reflection, as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. Faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Now through the rain and the sun, go your ways with gladness, with love in your hearts, peace and beauty touching your soul.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitariansa@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.